Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. And today we're not talking about food, we're talking actually about buildings. My guest is Tom Fox, as I call him. Tom is a writer who writes on far-ranging interests, among them sustainability and resilience. We've already decided that we're going to find a new word for sustainability, by the way. He is an attorney and a research editor at Reader's Digest. Fox is the author of Greentown USA and Urban Farming, Sustainable City Living in Your Backyard, in Your Community, and in the World. His work has been published in the Washington Post, the Wine Enthusiast, and elsewhere, and he tweets at Farmer-esque. That's Farmer like E-S-Q as in Esquire. So the book that we're going to talk about today is Greentown USA, and the subtitle for that book is The Handbook for America's Sustainable Future. And Tom, this is the story of a town, much like Moore, Oklahoma, just recently in Kansas, that was wiped out by a tornado. It was quite a small town. So give us a little bit of background and tell us why you wrote the book.
Sure. Well, as you said, Greensburg is a pretty small city. It had about 1,500 people at the time. It's in south central Kansas, roughly halfway between Wichita and Dodge City. And up until 2007, it was known for just a few things regionally. It had a very interesting settler history. It had some local attractions that were quite interesting. And it was the seat of Kiowa County. But then in May 2007, everything changed when it became known worldwide for two things. The first was being positively devastated by an EF5 tornado. I mean, which...
And EF5 is even stronger than the one that hit Moore, because when I looked at the Moore, Oklahoma coverage, and that's the tornado that just wiped out that town of 40,000 mm-hmm. recently, that was only categorized as an EF4. So this one was an even higher force.
Yeah, the EF5s are the highest you can get, and that means that it has winds of over 205 miles per hour. So, I mean, it's a monster. And the one that hit Greensburg not only hit it directly, but it was over a mile and a half wide. So it was actually larger than the town itself. And so it just completely devastated the town. About 95% of the built structures were destroyed. And what that was sort of the first piece of the worldwide news. And the second was that the community committed not only to rebuilding, but to rebuilding as the greenest small city in rural America.
And I think that's a really interesting decision, because the greening of green lifestyles, sustainable choices, this is not what you would associate with a small town in Tornado Alley, Kansas. Where I would venture to guess that most of the residents vote Republican, and and it's got a very long rural agricultural history to it. And those are not cultural aspects that generally lend themselves to sort of forward-thinking, futuristic types of philosophies about how to live. So how did they get to that place where they were willing to address these, instead of going back to what they knew and doing what they've always done in the past? Why did they decide that this would be a better way to go forward?
Well, first, you're absolutely right. This is sort of the kind of thing that would have probably, just had a knee-jerk bad reaction to the typical Greensburger at the time. It would be associated with tree huggers.
Absolutely. PETA.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
Humane Society. Oh, my God. Ultimately suspect.
Absolutely.
Very bad people.
And, you know, even here, there were, you know, multiple reactions, which is sort of like green is a paint color. You know,
right.
That's not something we do. But it really started with a few of the town leaders deciding that they were going to rebuild, not just rebuild, but rebuild better. And when they came to sort of think about what better might mean, it probably started with some energy efficiency, you know, making things a little more efficient that way. But then Governor Sebelius really sort of let the cat out of the bag and said, you know, called it green. And so they had to sort of commit to that. And they ended up having a big ally in Daniel Wallach of Greensburg Greentown, which is a nonprofit formed just after the tornado.
Right.
And he was really able to speak to the people and sort of convince them that this wasn't some sort of plot foisted upon them, mm-hmm. but this was really a return to the heritage of their ancestors, who were, you know, much more thrifty and knew all the basic things. You know, for example, to build in an east-west orientation so that you maximize sunlight.
Right. I mean, there were actually a lot of initiatives like that that I thought were interesting, because the town itself was built on a north-south axis, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
Which did not promote harnessing the sun's power, or conversely, you know, sheltering from the sun's power. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that really interested me was he helped bring about the master plan.
Yes.
That they developed. Let's talk a little bit about that, because that got input from FEMA. It got a lot of support from FEMA, and that's not something I normally associate with FEMA. I associate FEMA with giving you some trailers and some bank cards and saying, bye-bye. Good luck.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think part of the success of Greensburg post-tornado probably had a lot to do with the fact that it was so close to Hurricane Katrina. Mm-hmm. So the federal government was falling over itself. You know, trying to help out. But apparently FEMA has this sort of 12-week long-term recovery process planning system that they employ in any community that's struck like this. And so they had a big hand in that, and they helped sort of organize all the different parties. You know, so you'd have people from the healthcare sector, people from the business sector, the school sector. And they really tried to engage everyone in this preliminary planning process. And the sort of upshot of that, one of them, was to create this master plan.
It was called the Sustainable Comprehensive Master Plan.
Oh,
I love
yes.
that. I love that it had this, like, incredible name to it.
Yeah, it created problems with me writing, you know, do I use an acronym or do I use this?
I can imagine. You had a lot of acronyms to manage there.
Yeah.
Yeah, between all the building materials and all the different plans.
Absolutely.
It was tough.
So anyway, you know, many communities have 15 or 20-year plans that sort of guide development, and, you know, they can measure themselves against it going forward. Greensburg did not. So they couldn't just appeal to, you know, the current master plan at the time of the tornado. They really had to create one from scratch. And so what happened was the state engaged an architectural firm known for sustainable building, known as BNIM, to sort of guide the process. And so there was sort of a 7-person team composed of Greensburg people who are sort of the action team behind it. Mm-hmm. BNIM was leading it. FEMA and lots of state and federal government organizations were also participating, as did the city government and Greensburg Greentown. And so together, you know, they really all sort of hashed out what they thought Greensburg could become, and really made a big effort to involve the community. So before the planning process, they really solicited what the public wanted, what they thought, what did Greensburg mean. And then twice during the process, they had community meetings involving over 300 people each time, and which in a community of 1,500 people is pretty
right.
impressive.
Right. That's most of the adult population,
yeah.
probably.
And so, you know, they engaged in this process, and the Sustainable Comprehensive Master Plan was the result, and that really has been guiding it.
Amazing. And so this guy, Daniel Wallach, tell me a little bit more about him, because he writes the foreword to the book,
mm-hmm.
and he was obviously a big, I guess, spokesperson for the plan, right? I mean, wasn't he the one who kind of really had the job of selling it to the community at large?
Absolutely.
And I love that he went back to the idea, not just thrifty, but common sense. I mean, mm-hmm. in a lot of the, because you have a lot of boxes with what he said,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, with his pitch, and it was really about, you know, well, guys, you know, your ancestors, when the settlers came out here, they weren't exactly, you know, building, you know, castles with lots of windows and
right.
stuff. I mean, it was, you know, they were sodders. There's no trees here. There's no, you know, like, how do we capture some of that spirit? And that seemed to be really the thing that sold it to the community, right?
Absolutely. So, you know, during this rebuilding process, there were lots of people who sort of helicoptered in, you know, some of them well-intentioned,
right.
some of them not. But Daniel, who had actually come from Colorado, where he had founded a nonprofit association and had transplanted to Kansas, he turned out to be just sort of the best salesman within town. And a lot of that was...
Was he living in Greensburg when this happened?
No, he was living about an hour away. And he and his wife, Catherine Hart, were watching the news that night. Everyone in the area was, because there was the possibility of a tornado. And then, you know, they heard that it struck. And shortly thereafter, I think they went out driving to go see if they could see what was going on in Greensburg. And they passed the ruins of a patrolman car of somebody from outside of Greensburg, but who had been trying to warn people who were not within siren distance that it was coming. And so the experience of seeing the city, which looked like a bomb, completely destroyed it, and, you know, seeing this patrolman sort of inspired them to bring their expertise to help the community figure out what it meant to be green and how to make it happen.
Very interesting. Now, this town was about 150 years old, is that right?
Yeah, I think it was...
It was an early homesteading settler town in Kansas. And so the architecture was, you describe it as a lot of Victorian houses, as well as a sort of mix of more modern stuff. But obviously the town hadn't changed a whole lot. I was amazed that it hadn't been hit by tornadoes before, given that it is in that location of what they call Tornado Alley.
Right, right. I mean, I think the chance of any one community getting hit in a year is probably pretty slim. I think there may have been a tornado in the area that actually did hit in the 20s. But certainly not after that. And, you know, so they had houses that would be like houses in most of the United States, sort of stick frame construction.
Right.
Their main drag had some brick buildings. But, you know, there was nothing really built to resist tornadoes.
Right.
And really, you know, pretty much everything got destroyed except for two historic buildings and the co-op, which is this tremendous... grain silo built of concrete.
And we're going to talk about that because I thought that was really interesting. The co-op, and you have a photo of it in the book, is an enormous rounded structure. It looks like a silo, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is a silo, essentially. Exactly. And apparently, later on, as the plan unfolded to build in a more sustainable way, I mean, actually, one thing I was curious about during the book was I didn't read a lot of stuff that was specifically to withstand tornado, except for that one house that's built with the sort of dome wings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I forget whose house that was.
The Eller family,
But they started to realize, some of the people started to realize that one way to protect their homes was to build rounded structures or rounded corners. Mm-hmm. I was surprised that more people didn't follow that model, since that seems to be something that's, you know, cyclone friendly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is a little surprising. You know, there were the Eller family is sort of ambitious in making that. Greensburg Greentown's headquarters is in a house called the Silo Eco Home. And what it is basically a short silo built just like a silo would be with poured concrete walls. And just to sort of demonstrate to the public how, you know, resilient this sort of shape and construction method is, they dropped a car from like 60 feet up onto the roof twice, and it, you know, doesn't do anything.
Right.
I think a lot of the houses were not rebuilt particularly strong. Some of them might have been built with 2x6s instead of 2x4s.
Yes.
Which makes them a bit stronger and allows for about 50% more insulation. And certainly a lot of the public buildings were built with these insulated concrete forms, which are very strong. So they could probably withstand a tornado like this.
A five.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know that they have been tested, you know, because...
You can't really test for 205
right.
per hour winds. I mean, that's got to be a tough test. I wouldn't want to be in that test.
No.
No. Joe, why don't we take a quick break, and we'll come right back with Tom Fox, author of Greentown USA. We're talking about sustainable building practices and something that we're all going to have to think more about as climate change continues to evolve and change our planet. We'll be right back with What Doesn't Kill You.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world, highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insight with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. This is the Heritage Radio Network, and we're broadcasting live from Roberta's in the back of in Bushwick, Brooklyn, New York at 261 Moore Street. Brunch is being served. And my guest today is in the studio, which is kind of unusual for me these days. I'm doing a lot of phoners. But my guest is Tom Fox. Tom is the author of Greentown USA, and it's a handbook. It literally is a handbook for how to build a more sustainable sustainable dwellings and infrastructure in communities. And I suspect that we're going to be, especially in that part of the world, in Kansas and what they call Tornado Alley, they're going to be needing more and more of those tricks of the trade. Especially since we see more of these major, since that tornado in 2007, which was kind of the beginning of these tremendous wind events in the Midwest. Have you been keeping track of how many more there have been? There's been Joplin.
Yeah, there's Joplin.
And there's been a series of smaller tornadoes that have done less damage but still been pretty devastating. Am I right in that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there have been 10 EF5 ones.
Good Lord.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, they're not always as large in diameter. They don't always hit an entire part of a city. They might just, plow down a few blocks.
Right.
Which I think was the case in Moore. A big part of the city was affected, but not all of the city.
Right.
I think many of these communities are not really prepared to face that sort of event. But, at the same time, people like us here on the coast aren't really capable of dealing with floods.
We're not prepared for hurricanes.
Yeah.
Right. But it is interesting to think because, as people begin to construct new buildings, as, development continues to grow out in the Midwest, which I'm sure it will, there's all these new technologies and some people are using them, like in Greentown.
Yes.
But some people are not. So can you give us some idea of what are some of the new building materials that were employed in Greensburg to, make their houses stronger and especially more eco-friendly?
Sure. Two of the most popular technologies are insulated concrete forms, which are also called ICFs, and structural insulated panels, which are SIPs.
Yeah.
And so the insulated concrete form is basically, if you can imagine a cinder block, but instead of being made out of concrete, it's made out of foam on either side. And they can be assembled sort of like Legos.
Uh-huh.
And you can build a whole wall with them. And when the wall is complete, it actually has this empty central space where concrete can be poured in. And so that's what they do is they just frame out the walls. In one case, one of these buildings was framed out in less than 20 days.
I know. I was going to say that the construction time is really reduced using these pre-made forms, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then, they just pour in concrete. It stays in place. And then you have a wall that's insulated on both sides. It's pretty much impermeable to air and water. And it's just very well insulated, very strong. And I think, probably the reason that has caught on so much in town is, thought of another tornado.
Right. What about other towns in that whole area, in Oklahoma, Kansas, Missouri, are more and more companies, construction companies, offering that for sale? Do you follow like a big uptick in the? Should we be buying stock?
that's
what I really want to know.
Yeah, I tried to take a quick look. I don't know that the sales have increased so much, but it also corresponded with sort of a great decrease in the housing market. So it's not a great time
that's
to
true.
Consider it.
Right.
But, in addition to the insulated concrete forms, there are these things called structural insulated panels. Now, what they are is basically imagine sort of like a big frame, maybe like 4 by 8 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And right in the center is a big slab of foam, and then it's sandwiched in by two sort of pieces of plywood. Structures can also be built with those. And, again, very, very quickly. And they can even be loaded onto the truck from the factory such that you unload them in order and just slap them together. And because they have two beams together when they're, two panels together when they're put side by side,
right.
It's actually much stronger than regular construction. And so that's another one they've used, and I think one that probably has a lot of promise.
And that is green because it's already insulated? Or why is that particularly quote-unquote green or sustainable?
Sure. They're both considered green, pretty green, because they're excellently insulated. So, they reduce energy use in a house, like easily 40%. You know, they can last a very long time. They're very strong.
Right.
There is some question of the use of the foam. That's one issue because
That certainly crossed my mind.
Yeah, based on hydrocarbons. but it, at least in the case of structural insulated panels, they can use recycled foam. It's basically, it's sort of like styrofoam.
Right.
And so, which is generally not recycled.
Definitely
not. So it's a
not.
Use, a use for that that's sort of productive. And then the other thing is, certainly with the ICFs, is concrete, because, you know, the glue of concrete is cement, and cement is incredibly carbon intensive. So a pound to produce a pound of cement produces about a pound of carbon dioxide.
Wow.
So, you know, there is some question that it's a cost-benefit analysis, but certainly LEED buildings can be made with either of those. You can get points for using them.
Uh-huh.
So,
yeah, some of these buildings were LEED platinum.
Yes.
Now, I have friends in the building community who would suggest that the whole LEED thing is really not quite on the right track. But but that's another discussion. I mean, so what you're saying is that people could save 20 or more than up to 40% or more of energy costs in terms of heat exchange, whether it's cooling or heating in the winter, because they build with these products. That's what makes their house energy efficient. It's not the product itself. It's the actual benefit of the product.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a tremendous insulator. And you'd also have to, you know, make sure that the house is fairly sealed.
Yeah, you talked about the thermal envelope.
Yeah, the thermal envelope.
Yeah. Tell me about the thermal envelope.
That's basically all of the components of a house that keep air in or out. So,
right.
You know, the doors, the windows.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want a tight thermal envelope. And these two technologies create incredibly tight thermal envelopes. But also, going to what your friend said about LEED, I don't know that that's sort of the way to go either. You know, another thing that was used here in Greensburg were the Advanced Energy Design Guides, which were sort of promoted by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, which are much simpler guides that, you know, for building a more traditional, let's say, you know, 2x6 house. And achieving through that, you know, probably 25% or greater energy savings, but only just for a few thousand dollars more. So, you know.
Whereas these other products that you're talking about, the SIPs and the ICFs, are more expensive than that.
They are more
substantially more expensive.
It varies a lot. It depends, you know, for example, if you have the materials within, you know, 100 miles of the site.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you could recoup the costs very quickly in energy
for
them.
Sure, 40% savings is pretty substantial.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, I think in many of the new homes in Greensburg follow the AEDG guidelines rather than LEED,
mm-hmm.
And they have 40% savings in energy.
Mm-hmm.
So it can certainly be done using, you know, less flashy criteria.
So how did these people, I mean, did they get FEMA money to pay those extra costs? I mean, when people had to rebuild their homes, like the Ellers, as you described, or mm-hmm. a couple of the other families that built really sort of showcase homes,
mm-hmm.
How were they financed? Were they willing to pay the extra cost because they saw the benefit at the end of it, or were they given some subsidies? And would, for instance, does government offer subsidies for that kind of thing?
Well, about 75% of the homeowners received insurance payments, but the insurance payments were about $50,000, which really wasn't enough to build a new home. So I think the people who did build new homes were often people who wanted to stay, who had money, were willing to
right.
put in a substantial amount themselves. But sort of one of the other interesting things I found about the town, and sort of a lesson for another community, is just how much aid poured in. So, for example, the school building, which is gorgeous, and it's LEED platinum, it's $55 million.
Wow.
75% of that cost was insurance because two other schools were totaled.
Right.
And FEMA, in that case, put up a lot of money. And the government, state, local government, covered the rest.
Also had to,
right.
They would have to kick in because it's a state institution or a public institution.
And
yeah.
So, yeah, with a lot of the public buildings, they got mm-hmm. a combination of insurance mm-hmm. and funds from government without the town having to take on a huge burden.
So would you say that these, I mean, first of all, the town of Greensburg has become a little bit of an eco-tourist center. Am I right in that?
You are right. I think it has not become as much as
of
a little mecca as they would have liked.
Yeah.
But
we're going to do our best right now to make
yes,
that happen.
Yes, absolutely. Go there. But it has. And certainly it's been a place that people from other communities where there have been tragedies go to.
Uh-huh.
And people from Greensburg travel all around to bring, you know, sort of like the message of how to rebuild after a disaster like this to those communities.
So they have been on the site of more in more Oklahoma, no doubt, right? Now, but my question was, like, you know, Greensburg, like, this is a great story, and I love it, and I loved what they did, and I thought it was terrific that the but there were only, like, 1,900 residents in the whole town. So when you talk about a bigger community like Joplin mm-hmm. or Moore, how much can you get people to do sort of the same thing, do you think? I mean, has Greensburg become what it hoped to become as a kind of bellwether or a leader in this field? Or are people in bigger communities just saying, oh, well, that's just like a little tiny town. They can do whatever they want.
Well, I mean, it's absolutely right that, I mean, Greensburg is exceptional. I think partly they just acted very boldly in you know, saying they were going to be the greenest mm-hmm. town in America. But also, I mean, I did just a quick calculation of the aid they got from federal and state government and some big corporations. And it turns out being something like $90,000 per resident. And then if you compare that with, let's say, the $30 billion New York State asked for after Sandy, you know, that's less than $3,000 per resident. So, I mean, they got an incredible outlay of money. And I think, you know, no communities going forward can expect that. And sort of one of the lessons is to plan. I mean, it's the least sexy thing in the world, but to plan for these sorts of events because yeah. when they happen, you are not going to get that kind of help.
Right. And why did they get so much money as compared to, say, you know, disasters down the road? Was it just because our disaster funds were depleted? Because they were right after Katrina. Katrina was 2006, right?
I think Katrina was 2006.
Yeah, so they were 2007.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly I think the federal government jumped in sort of with the big boots because of Katrina, making up for that. So that's unlikely to happen
again. So that was still under the Bush administration?
Yes.
I see.
Yeah, so...
Well, they didn't get anything like the public relations bump they probably wanted because, I mean, God knows I didn't hear about this. I mean,
right,
really,
right. And know? And Bush went twice.
he did. He went to the town twice. Oh, nice.
once very shortly afterwards.
An asshole.
And then once to give the, I think, the graduation commencement speech.
Mm-hmm.
And Kansas certainly kicked in a lot of money. And there were a lot of corporations because they, you know, said they wanted to have this whole green initiative. You know, PepsiCo gave them a lot of money for the Sunships Business Incubator.
Uh-huh.
They got a lot from Leonardo DiCaprio, whose production company was interested in doing a reality series on it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that brought in money. And they just sort of benefited from all of these things, as well as, you know, thousands and thousands of volunteers doing things on site.
Right.
But I think, yeah, going forward, between, you know, the increasing frequency of these sorts of events, maybe not tornadoes themselves, but certainly hurricanes and flooding.
Well, I don't know. I think tornadoes are certainly on the increase. I mean, you just told us that there were seven Category 5 hurricanes in the last few years. I mean, that's huge. There's obviously you never heard about that before. I mean, a big cyclone like that was not happening, like, on a regular basis the way it does seem to now.
Well, I mean, I know that in sort of current modeling, they don't know if tornadoes will increase or become more intense, unlike mm-hmm. hurricanes, which will likely both increase and become more intense.
Right.
So, you know, that could just be sort of the effect of, you know, if you throw a bunch of darts at a wall, there you can circle a cluster. It might have been just sort of bad luck that these particularly strong ones hit communities. Because if they didn't have a community, you'd probably never hear about it.
Absolutely. Right. You know? If it goes across some farmer's, you know, 200-acre or whatever, 2,000-acre corn belt,
mm-hmm.
you know, too bad. Crop insurance takes care of him, but
that's right.
No problems. Thanks to our farm bill. Yeah. We always got to have the crop insurance for the big farms. Anyway, unfortunately, we have to close up, Tom, but I want you to tell people where they can read more about your book and possibly purchase it.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. And if you have any events coming up, any readings or anything like that, you should definitely put that up, too.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, I don't have any readings coming up. The book is actually officially launched this Tuesday. You can find it.
I scooped everyone
you
on
did.
This one.
You did.
I like that.
I hope you reap the rewards.
Yeah, me too.
So it's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. You can get it for Kindle, Nook, iPad.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so this Tuesday, look for it.
Absolutely. So Thomas Fox is the name of our author, and thank you so much for joining me today, Tom. And do you have a website, by the way?
I do. It's farmeresk.com.
Right, but as in lawyer. Yeah.
Yes, but it's in a miserable shape right now. So,
okay, so
look again in a few months.
Just buy the book.
Yes.
Buy the book. And thank you so much for joining me today. Thanks for my sponsor, and thank you, Joe, for engineering.
Thank you for having me.
This has been another episode of What Doesn't Kill You. We'll see you next week with more information about the food industry. Thanks for listening, folks. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.